just wants to get started, but I really want to say just a few words to welcome him. First of all, we have an anonymous donor for this morning, so I also want to thank our donor. They know who they are, and we really, really appreciate it. Also thank Young Israel Century City for sharing Rabbi Leibowitz. And the shul in general, you know, this is a big deal for our shul. We're a very modest shul, and I think we're doing something very important. We are revitalizing a shul that was built by Holocaust survivors that wasn't sure, you know, would make it a few years ago. We're also kind of extending the boundaries of the neighborhood down here. And so, you know, it's been a really special thing for our shul. And whenever we're able to do something like this, it's a big kavod for our shul. And we still talk about the last time Rabbi Leibowitz was here. We really want to, it's really important for us. And it, actually, Adam pointed out on Shabbos that last time Rabbi Leibowitz spoke here, he had 5,000 shirim on YU Torah. And that now he's just about at 10,000. So, first of all, we advertised it to excite people. We said, this might be number 10,000. We're not sure, but be here for the 10,000th year, maybe, give or take. And also, we hope that we can have Rabbi Leibowitz at least every, you know, 5,000 year would be a great pattern. This rate, that'll be pretty soon, I think, for the next 5,000, Mitzvah Hashem, it should be. But just a couple words about Rabbi Leibowitz, because I just want to say, to be able to welcome and thank him publicly. It was interesting, the things that people said to me over Shabbos. As we were, you know, mentioning the schluss that we have to have early voice this morning. The first thing one person said to me was, Rabbi Leibowitz is a real Talmud Chacham. He's the real deal. So I was thinking, okay, yes, this is why people are attracted to him. He's a real Talmud Chacham. Then someone else said to me, oh, I love him because his style is just so wonderful to listen to. It's just the way he talks is just so nice to listen to. I thought, yes, this is why people love Rabbi Leibowitz. He has a way of communicating that's great to listen to. And then someone said to me, wow, 10,000 shirim, is he still going strong? Is he still like able to give shirim after all that? He's still like, I said, he's my age. I thought he was like elderly. The person who had met him before didn't realize that he's a young rabbi. He's maybe a year or two older than me. And that's really the point that I wanted to make, which is for me. And I think it's true for a lot of people. I think Kobe, my son, has said the same thing to me. You know, it's great. I listen to Rabbi Leibowitz in the car, and I come home, and Kobe, my son, is listening to him, you know, over his Gemara. And why do we love him so much? Why is he giving 10,000 shirim? It's not like he just sits in his office giving, you know, recording podcasts. It's because people want to hear him. People want to hear what he has to say. And I think a major part of that, at least for me, at least the bracha that it is in my, that Rabbi Leibowitz is in my life, is that, you know, to have someone who speaks in a way who you can relate to them. I feel like I'm listening to someone who could be my friend, and it inspires me. You know, it's someone who has a tremendous love of Torah, a tremendous love of Talmidei Chachamim, a tremendous love of Klal Yisrael, and it pushes me and it inspires me. And you know, I also love to listen. Of course, we have great gedolim. You know, we listen to Rav Asher Weiss, Rav Asher Schechter, and we have great, amazing people. There could be a little bit of a Yetzirah sometimes when I listen to them and it says, like, okay, they're great people. I'm not at their madrega. I'm not quite there. I want to aspire to that. And then I hear Rabbi Leibowitz, I can't have that same Yetzirah. I think this is some, I can try to emulate. This is someone who I can relate to. I want to be like this. It's someone who, just that relatability is something that's so special. It's someone who's also an incredible Talmud Chacham and who speaks with a great Koach HaDibur. And so it's just really special to be able to see him in person also, because we all listen to him. I know that a lot of people told me after he spoke last time, he started subscribing to him and listening, and to be able to listen to him in person is just a special bracha. So we want to thank him, and without further ado, Rabbi Leibowitz.
Thank you so much, Bob. Okay, thank you so much, Rabbi Weiner. It is an honor to be here, and I do very much cherish our friendship, and it's so wonderful that we're able to make such a wonderful connection from such a great distance, you know, thanks to the wonders of modern technology. I do feel a little bit inadequate, considering the topic is borders on medical ethics, and I am certainly not the most qualified person in the room to speak on medical ethics issues, or many other issues for that matter, but certainly on medical ethics issues, so I ask that you bear with me, and you know, feel free to correct me at any point in time. So what I like to do in general, first of all, thank you all for having me. It's wonderful to see everybody this morning. It's so inspiring to see people coming out on a Sunday morning to learn Torah together, really any time, but a Sunday morning tends to be a lazy morning where people could sleep in a little bit late, and to come to learn Torah is really an inspiring thing, and something that is certainly not lost on me, and it should be a great zuchus for all of you and your families that you should continue to always strive for a closer connection to the Ribono Shel Olam. But what I generally try to do is just share with you a few different questions, practical questions that came up, and then we'll discuss some of them just to get a sense of like the kinds of issues that Rabbanim are dealing with, that rabbis have to deal with, relating to the topic at hand. So the topic at hand, I think the advertisement was mental health, right? What was it? Something along the lines, questions relating to mental health and halacha. Rabbi Weiner reached out to me and said that there was a shiur I gave in Yeshiva University on this topic, and I posed like five different questions. I gave like five different scenarios, and I answered one of them. So he said, maybe answer some of the other ones. And, you know, we could. I don't remember which one I answered. Do you have any recollection? I have no idea which one I answered, so I hope I'm not repeating over here. I'm not going to do five. We'll do three, and then we'll answer maybe one of them also, but it will be based on your choice, which one you want to deal with. And I'm just going to share with you actual shailas that people asked, and just to give a sense of the kinds of issues that come up and just how diverse the situations are and the kind of sensitivity that Rabbanim need and the kind of education really that Rabbanim need in order to be able to deal with these kinds of issues. And obviously whenever you're dealing with a mental health issue, a rabbi, unless he's also a trained mental health professional, is not capable of dealing with these kinds of issues on his own. He needs to deal with it in consultation, just like a medical halacha issue needs to be in consultation with doctors, and doctors in consultation with rabbis. So the doctors have to be aware of that also when it's a medical halacha issue and not just a medical issue. There are unfortunately sometimes doctors that are very happy to tell people not to fast on Yom Kippur, for example, and they're Torah observant doctors, because why would you fast, right? Well, meaning but it's important that it be done in consultation with each other, with respect for each other's area of knowledge. So too when it comes to mental health, it has to be done in consultation with mental health professionals to get a sense of what's appropriate, what's not appropriate, what works and what doesn't work. And it's important that the poskim that we consult with have some familiarity with mental health, because it's very complicated. In a certain sense, mental health is much more complicated than physical health. Our understanding of the human brain is nowhere near our understanding. The level of our understanding of the human brain does not even approach our understanding of, for example, the human heart. It's just so much more complicated. There are so many, and every person is different, and it becomes very, very complex. So again, I'm going to share with you three shailas. So shaila number one was from a Talmud in Yeshiva, a young man who suspects that he might be gay. Suspects. He's in his 20s. He's not sure. He's sort of working out his feelings right now. He's certainly feeling stirrings for other men, but he's not sure he might also be attracted to women, or if he can maybe develop an attraction to women. He is a very frum boy, and he wants to get married and build a family. His therapist has recommended that he's in therapy for other things. He is, as everyone should probably be, but his therapist has recommended that he try developing a relationship with a woman where some semi-intimate touching is done, so that he can get a sense as to whether he in fact is attracted to women. The therapist says it has worked for some people in the past and hasn't worked for others, but he figured it's worth a try. The boy is in law school right now, and he thought maybe I should try going on a date or two with a non-Jewish girl and being physical with her, because I can't ask a Jewish girl to engage in any sort of physical relationship with me. So maybe some sort of to befriend a non-Jewish girl and see in some at least semi-casual way to be somewhat physical with her, to see if he could develop this attraction, or if he has any sort of attraction to women. So that is shaila number one. Shaila number two, I got from an ER doctor in my neighborhood. There's a doctor who lives across the street from me. It's great to have when you have children around the house. It's really fantastic to have an ER doctor across the street from you. Every time one boy pushes another boy, or someone trips. trips, I should say, and there's some bleeding, so it's good to have him around for a lot of reasons. But anyway, he told me the following situation happened in his hospital. A baby came into the emergency room, and Rahman al-Islam, the baby was totally unresponsive, and they started working on the child, and after a few minutes it became clear that barring a miracle, they were not going to bring this child back, that he unfortunately had passed away. However, the doctor says, they are in their training, they're told that there are studies that indicate that parents who lose a child will have a better chance at closure if they see the doctors working on the child. The parents had not arrived at the hospital yet. The child was brought to the hospital by a caretaker, and the parents were minutes away from the hospital. So the other doctors suggested that they continue to work on the child until the parents arrive at the hospital so that they can call it once the parents are there. And they continued to work on the baby until a few minutes after the parents got there, and then they pronounced the child dead. And he wanted to know, did we do the right thing? Is it inappropriate, once you know that the child is dead, to continue to work on the child, to continue to be mutchering the child and be in order for the mental health of the parents, meaning the parents are going to go through a serious ordeal right now, and if you can make it even incrementally lighter, or in some way make it more tolerable, not that it will be tolerable, but somewhat more something that they can that will be better for them in their recovery process from this terrible, terrible loss. So is that an appropriate thing to do, considering that we'll have to discuss if we choose the Shaila, you know, what the loss is on one side versus the other side. So that is Shaila number two. Shaila number three, I got an email from a guy named Shlomo, and the email reads as follows. My name isn't really Shlomo. It said Shlomo on there, but it starts. My name isn't really Shlomo, but I wanted to ask a private question, so I thought best to ask anonymously. There is a condition, I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly, paruresis. Am I pronouncing that correctly? Anyone know that condition? He explains it, which is commonly known as shy bladder syndrome. What it means is that someone can't use the bathroom in the presence of others, i.e. a public bathroom. The condition ranges from not being able to go into a public bathroom to simply being uncomfortable using a urinal. Additionally, when one has this condition, they can't just make themselves go. Sometimes they have to wait for everyone to leave the bathroom before they can go. Statistics show that 2.8% of the world population has this, which is an astonishingly high number, right? That means out of every 25 people. So 2.8% of the world population has this, which means that a lot of people have this condition but don't want to talk about it. The area that this condition becomes an issue is before davening. A lot of times I'll need to go to the bathroom before Maariv or Mincha, but the only option is a public bathroom. It's not that I can just make myself go in a pressurized situation of needing to go a couple of minutes before Maariv. Many a time I just end up waiting, davening Maariv, and going later. I know that technically I have 72 minutes, but I'm nervous that I'm in violation of the Isra of Bal Tishaktu, which is the violation of, it means a lot of things, but one of the things that Bal Tishaktu means is that a person is not supposed to hold themselves back from using the bathroom when they need to. Every fourth grader is fully aware of that Isra in the Torah, because when the teacher doesn't let them go to the bathroom, but yeah, Apikairis, it's Bal Tishaktu, you can't tell me that I'm not allowed to go to the bathroom. So the fellow asks, what does Rebbe think? Meaning, Rebbe being me, what do I think about this issue? Can he daven Maariv knowing that he has to use the facilities, but he's not going to be able to use the bathroom until later on? So these are the three shilas. So again, shila number one was curing, I shouldn't use the word curing, but to explore same-sex attraction or opposite-sex attraction through experimental touching. Shaila number two, treating a dying baby for the sake of the parents, and not for the sake of the baby. And shaila number three, davening while having to use the bathroom. So we're going to take a vote by a show of hands and not a show of voices, because whenever we do a show of voices, the loudest voice wins. So we're going to do by a show of hands, which shaila you'd like to discuss. All those who want to talk about shaila number one this morning, okay, a couple of people. All those who want to talk about shaila number two this morning, and shaila number three. It's like a tie, a three-way tie. Now what do I do? That never happens. Usually, like, there's one obvious winner.
I vote for number one, but I didn't put my hand up.
Okay, so I guess try the number one. Yeah, one, is that okay? Yeah, you think that's... Yeah. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, maybe get you like a little bit number one and then one of the others as well.
Okay.
Whatever you think's better. Whatever
okay.
Better.
What's our timing? I didn't even ask that question.
Yeah, we have less than half an
hour. Okay.
It's Sunday. We've only got 1 hour.
Okay. So let's start with Shaila number one. There are a number of assumptions that Shaila number one makes, right? You always have to, whenever you're dealing with any question in halacha, so someone presents a question, you have to always say, well, what kinds of assumptions have you made before you even ask the question? I mean, there are obviously certain things that you're working, certain assumptions that you're working with. So one assumption that he's working with is that in order to get married, he has to straighten this out, right? That he can't get married knowing that he has no taiva for women, that would be wrong and that would be prohibited. And I think, you know, I'm not going to make any assumptions about what everyone else here believes, but I certainly believe that that is definitely the case, that it would be irresponsible and cruel to get married if a boy does not know that he can be attracted to a woman. So that's an assumption that we're working with. I actually dealt with a case, unfortunately, a very sad case of a fellow who was in yeshiva, and he felt that he was not attracted to women, and he was a mitsuyan, he was an exceptional bachur in yeshiva, he was learning at a very, very high level, and his rebbeim kept on saying, he told his rebbeim, he said, what do I do about this? And all the Rosh Yeshiva's daughters, you know, all the Rosh Yeshiva wanted him for their daughter because he was such an exceptional learner, and his rebbeim kept on saying, don't worry, it will come, it'll be, you're just nervous. And he wasn't just nervous, and now it's years later, and he's struggling mightily. It's a very terrible, terrible situation. His life is, and his wife's life are really, he has children, it's a Gehenna, it's very, very difficult. So that's, that we're going to take as an assumption. Getting married if he has no taiva for women is wrong and prohibited. Second, just as a comment, you always have to think, well, is there another Eitzah instead of actually using like a real live human being as an experiment? You know, is there another Eitzah, something you could do? Meaning there is a multi-billion dollar industry that we try to avoid, and is a very powerful force for an evil in this world, but maybe can be used for positive in this case, right? There's you can use what you know, in the old days what we would call magazines, but nowadays you don't need a physical magazine. I mean, don't use real live human women, just see if they're he's tried that and he still feels like he needs to develop some sort of emotionally. His therapist tells him he feels that maybe if you develop some sort of emotional connection, that the physical side will come along with that. But to just have the physicality removed from any emotional connection, that it's not going to be a true test of whether he's able to develop a relationship. So, and third thing is that it's important to realize that sometimes you don't have to paskin the shaila. Sometimes there's a shaila that the rabbi can sort of finesse his way out of paskening, and the person will do what they do. And that's a bit of a controversial statement, but I've had this experience with Rav Asher Weiss, who, by the way, Rav Asher Weiss has told me on multiple occasions how much he loves your rabbi. He has such a fondness for him, for obvious reasons. But Rav Asher Weiss, I once had probably the craziest shaila I ever got. I asked Rav Asher Weiss, and the shaila revolved was about a fellow who had emailed me, a rabbi who had emailed me from a different country, and he told me that there was a guy who was a major supporter of the Jewish community in his country, and that this fellow, who was the major supporter of the Jewish community, was not Torah observant for many, many years. And he started becoming more Torah observant through supporting the shul and the Kiruv organization. So he started becoming more Torah observant. He started attending shiurim and he started attending davening, and everything was really trending in a positive direction. There was only one little problem. He was married to a non-Jewish woman for the last 35 years. He was married to a non-Jewish woman. So, okay, no problem if she's willing to convert, you know, and she's also interested, and she's also keeping a kosher home now and observing and also coming to classes. So, great idea. Let her convert, and then they'll be able to live happily ever after. Problem is, the fellow is a Kohen. So a Kohen is not allowed to marry a convert. So if she converts, he's not allowed to marry her. So this fellow was attending a class in Maseches Yevamos, and in the class he learned that if a Kohen is a Patsua Daka, which means that if a Kohen is castrated, then he's allowed to marry a Kohen because he loses his kahuna. So we think castrated, that's crazy. But it's a procedure that's done in every hospital in this country all the time. It's very easy. Anyone can go in and say, I would like to have a vasectomy. And they do it without a problem. And that halachically might be castration, halachically. So the fellow says, I have a great idea. Why don't I just get a vasectomy? And if I get a vasectomy, then I won't be a Kohen anymore. And then I'll be allowed to marry my wife. My wife will be able to convert, and I'll be able to stay married to my wife. He came up with this, as Rav Shachter called an Einfall, he came up with this chap, on the spot. And he asked his local rabbi if he could do this. Now, there is an Isser in the Torah that you're not allowed to get a vasectomy. Not only are you not allowed to do that, you're not even allowed to do to a pet. A lot of people, I don't know what's going on over here, but in my part of the world, COVID brought a lot of new pet ownership into the world. Everyone got dogs. Everyone has COVID dogs now. So there are a lot of people that have pets for the first time and don't know the first thing about the halachos of keeping a pet. And one of the most important halachos is that there's an Isser d'oraisa that you're not allowed to neuter a pet, but you have to neuter a pet. So you have to figure out how you're allowed to do it. Ask your local Orthodox rabbi what the protocol is to neuter a pet. But certainly to neuter a human is going to, the Torah says not to neuter an animal, and we say, kal v'chomer, you're not allowed to neuter a human being. So there's an issue to do this. So the fellow says, yeah, but I've been married for 35 years. I'm not divorcing my wife, right? So either I'm going to continue to be married to a non-Jewish woman, which every single day of my life is going to be a violation of that Isser, or I'll violate one Isser of getting this procedure, and then for the rest of my life, I'll be able to live beheter. I'll be able to live happily ever after. So that was his cheshbon. So I asked Rav Asher Weiss this question. I remember we went to visit Rav Asher when his wife, Alei Shalom, was ill, and he was in Manhattan in the hospital with her. So it was amazing to see how he was balancing, continuing to deal with the world's shailas as he was going through this personal trauma and difficulty of dealing with his wife's illness and being there for her at every moment of every day. So we went to visit him in the lobby of the hospital, essentially, and I asked him this shaila. And his short answer was, don't paskin it. Don't tell him what is, what isn't, whether it's usher or whether it's mutter. He'll probably just do it. And once he does it, then you'll be Magai or the wife. But you can't tell him it's mutter to do, it's usher to do. So sometimes you just don't paskin the shaila. You can tell him, your cheshbon is correct, but there's no way that it's mutter to do it, but your cheshbon is correct. Meaning, and then he'll figure out what to do, and he'll just do it. So sometimes you don't paskin the shaila. Sometimes you have to let things work themselves out. It's a very rare case that you don't do that, because people look to the halacha for guidance and to know how to serve Hashem properly. And then a fourth point as a preamble over here to make is that this, obviously, the whole enterprise is a very controversial topic. The whole idea that you can do this, that you could start experimenting and that will somehow change a person or enable a person to discover their true sexuality, it's a very controversial topic. According to the American Psychiatric Association, there's an opposition. The American Psychiatric Association opposes psychiatric treatment based upon the assumption that homosexuality per se is a mental disorder or based upon the assumption that a patient should change his or her homosexual orientation, and it describes attempts to change a person's sexual orientation by practitioners as unethical. Now, the Torah doesn't have to answer to the American Psychiatric Association, but we certainly have to be cognizant of the way the world sees this, and also if it's in fact damaging to a person, and if it could turn a person, be dangerous for a person in some way or another. So we always have to be cognizant of that. Now, happens to be that this young man is not saying that he is gay. Meaning, one of the things that people seem to agree on, from the left to the right and everyone in between, is that there is a spectrum. Meaning that it's not like a switch, are or aren't. That there is some sort of spectrum, and he's trying to figure out where he is on that spectrum, and if he can make it work to be married to a woman being on the, you know, wherever he is on that spectrum. So that is that's the preamble. Now, what are the halachic issues? What's he asking to do? He's asking to go to his graduate school, and befriend a non-Jewish woman, which likely will happen anyway in a study group or something. He's going to be interacting with other people, and then go out for a coffee or something and see what happens, see if there are any stirrings that develop. What's the isser in doing that? What would be the avera? What's the downside? Let's start with that. What's the downside?
Could be a Harig Val Yavar.
It could be a Harig Val Yavar. That's a pretty big downside. Yeah. Why is he a Harig Val Yavar?
It's an
Abizrayu of Arayos. Is a non-Jewish woman Arayos?
For Chassas it is.
Perhaps, right? Perhaps. Okay. He's not looking to get married, though, right? We'll have to discuss that. I mean, what's the Isser to marry a non-Jew? It's the worst Isser in the whole Torah, right? But what exactly is the Isser? It's not so clear. We'll have to get to that. Yeah.
I didn't know what that meant.
Abizrayu v'arayos. Good. So there are three averos in the Torah. There are three prohibitions in the Torah that the halacha says that one has to get killed rather than violate those prohibitions, and they are murder, avodah zarah, right, idolatry, and gilui arayos, which is sexual immorality. So if a person has someone hold a gun to your head and say you need to sleep with that married woman who's not married to you, married to somebody else, or I'm going to kill you, you have to take the bullet rather than sleep with the married woman. So there are a list of the arayos in the Torah, like if someone holds a gun to your head, you have to sleep with your sister, or I'm going to put a bullet through your head, you have to take the bullet rather than sleep with your sister, right? So that's Yaharig Val Yavar. So there's a concept called Abizrayu Dekile Arayos. It's something that's not the actual violation itself of sexual immorality, but borders on it, or leads to it, or something, might also be included in Yeharig Val Yavar, and having to get killed rather than to violate the Avera, which is, it's like hard for people to internalize that concept. You know, we're not used to the idea of, you know, we've been spending the last 2 years highlighting how much our religion believes in the value of human life, and we do. We believe in the value of human life above almost everything, but not exactly everything. Meaning there are certain violations that are considered so terrible that we'd rather give up our lives than violate them. Meaning, for is it worth living life as a murderer or to get killed? And apparently the Torah tells us it is better to get killed than to live the rest of your life as a murderer, as someone who has killed somebody else. It is worth getting killed rather than being an idolater. So the suggestion was that it might be a violation of Abizrayu Dekilui Arayos, an offshoot of the prohibition of sexual immorality, to go out on a date with a non-Jewish woman and engage in some sort of physical touch to test things out. So that's possibility number one. Any other prohibitions that this may involve? Which woman? To the non-Jewish woman that he's going to... Right, meaning, how can you do this to non-Jewish? You're using her as an experiment? Meaning, do you have to tell her in advance that you're using her as an experiment? She's probably not going to be willing to go out if you tell her in advance that you're using her as an experiment. So that seems like... Let's call that gnevas das, meaning one is not allowed to fool other people into, to engage them based on a premise that's not true. You know, the Gemara tells us in Maseches Chulin, Daf Tzadi Dalid, that it's also lignov das abrios vafilu das akum, which means that you're not allowed to engage in gnevas das, you're not allowed to trick other people or engage again with other people based on a false premise. The Gemara tells a story. I'll give an example of gnevas das. The Gemara says that a fellow was going on Shmuel, one of the Gedolei Amorayim, one of the great Amorayim, was going on a ferry boat somewhere, and he had his attendant with him, he had his shamash traveling with him. And at the end of the ride, they gave a tip. You know, like the Ubers, you know, on the app, it says you want to leave this kind of tip, that kind of tip. Do they rate you before the tip or after? I'm not sure. So he wanted to give a tip, but they didn't have an app back in the times of the Gemara. So the attendant, the shamish, had a tray for chicken with him. They had checked the chickens that morning, and not all the chickens, one of them turned out to be treif. So he had a tray for chicken with him. So he gave the ferry driver the tray for chicken as a tip. So the ferry driver said, thank you very much. Now I have dinner for my family. And Shmuel got upset at his shamish, at his attendant, and he said, that's Geneva Stas, to give the tray for chicken as a tip, because he thinks, the person, the driver thinks, that you're giving something up, that you actually could have used. But you have no use for that. You were going to throw it in the garbage otherwise. So it doesn't seem that you're giving him the impression that your relationship with him is one thing when it's really something else entirely. You're giving him the impression that you have so much gratitude that you're willing to give up a valuable chicken when in reality you're giving up a chicken that's absolutely worthless to you. And you're not allowed to do that. Even with there's no distinction when it comes to the issue of Geneva Stas between Jew and non-Jew. You're not allowed to do that with a Jew or a non-Jew. The ferry driver happened to have been non-Jewish. So here also, maybe one could argue that this is Geneva Stas. You can engage a girl in a semi-intimate relationship with no plan whatsoever of allowing this relationship to go anywhere. Isn't that a violation of Geneva Stas? So that's certainly something that could be discussed. You know, maybe let's deal with that one first. I think that it could be a violation of Geneva Stas. However, considering the state of relationships on campuses in America in the 21st century, it in all likelihood is not Geneva Stas. Meaning, I don't think there's any presumption I'm a little out of it. The campus I teach on only has young men on, you know, and they're all religious. So the considering the state of how things work on college campuses nowadays, it doesn't seem that there's any assumption of any long-term relationship. People are more than happy to engage in casual relationships, left and right. And I don't know that that's a violation of Geneva Stas. Now, does she know that you're experimenting? It's very possible, equally possible, that if she knew that you are experimenting, she would be flattered and honored to be able to help you figure this out. Because everything is, that's just the state of being in that environment. So I'm not sure that this would be a violation of Geneva Stas. Just parenthetically, I always had a kasha. I'll share with you, maybe someone here has an answer, that there's a major, one of the major questions that comes up this time of year, a few weeks ago. Every rabbi in the country, I think, gets this shayla around the time of the year, the holiday season, that someone gets gifted a non-kosher bottle of wine, right? So can you re-gift it to somebody else? Can you give that bottle of wine to a coworker? It's not kosher, you have no use for it. So everyone discusses stam yenam, the fact that wine that's not kosher has certain prohibitions associated with it, that you're not allowed to benefit from it. Is giving it to someone else considered a benefit? You know, things of that nature. I always thought it's a violation of Gneva's Das, that the person you're giving it to doesn't realize that you have absolutely no use for it. They may realize that you're not allowed to drink it because it's not kosher and you're a religious Jew, but they probably don't realize that you're not allowed to sell it, and that you couldn't even put it on eBay and sell it for, you know, $8 or something, that you have mamish no use for it, and that putting aside anything else, that it would seem to me to be a violation of Geneva Stas. But I haven't seen any poskim that say that way, but it seems like exactly the case in the Gemara.
But don't you get out of the Geneva Stas issue by just being honest? Someone say, I have no use for it, or you say to the woman, I'm not sure if I'm gay or not, and I'm
yeah, you can get out of the Geneva Stas, right. That's 100% true. If you're honest, you'd get out of the Geneva Stas issue. Yeah.
In the case of Shmuel, by the end of the boat trip, the chicken probably would be rotten and not worth anything. If I have a bottle of non-kosher wine, I have 100 non-Jewish business associates that I could theoretically give it to.
Meaning the fact that you're choosing this one as opposed to somebody else?
Right.
That's value to you?
It's not the only guy I can give it to.
Interesting. Okay. Interesting.
It is totally worthless.
Potentially. Okay.
It's just a spark, but isn't that the case with any gift? I mean, I would give, I don't give a gift because you know, I personally like this thing. But
so he's saying, no, by the chicken it's not, because the chicken's going to spoil. They didn't have refrigeration. So by the chicken it's not, but in a chinami, had it been any other gift, then it wouldn't be Gneivas Das. The only reason it was Gneivas Das in the Gemara is because it was a chicken that was going to spoil anyway. So he had to give it to the first non-Jew that he was able to see. Okay, it's an Ukimta, assuming that he didn't have access to other people, that he was the only guy riding on the ferry, I guess. But yeah, okay. So now, a couple of other things over here. There's one issue that people didn't raise, and that is, this is a high-risk proposition. Meaning, what if it works out? And he really falls in love with this girl.
That's what Jackie was saying.
Oh, is that, yeah?
No,
is that? Okay. Meaning, that could be a real problem. Meaning, you want to take that kind of risk? Tell them to develop a relationship with a non-Jewish woman? Yeah?
There actually are therapists who are hired.
Oh, good. We'll get to that. Okay. That's the punchline. That's the punchline. We'll get to that. That's Rav Asher Weiss opened my eyes to that. I had no idea. How much? What's it? 5 minutes? Is that?
I mean, if you needed more time.
Okay. So let me just try to run through a couple of things. As far as you know, just engaging in the touch itself, and whether that's actually, as Jackie said, a Abizrayu Degila Arayus, whether that's considered to be a Harig Val Yavar. Now, there are for a man to touch a woman who is not his wife in a non-affectionate way, in a a handshake or something of that nature. So we generally assume, like the opinion of the Shach, that it is not a prohibition at all if it's a non-affectionate way. If it's not, it's what's called negiyah shelo b'derech taiva. If it's not done in a way that arouses a person's desire in any way. Although that is a machlokas haposkim, not all poskim agree with that. And what the borders, how we define what's non-affectionate, is also machlokas haposkim. But my rebbeim always assumed that if you're on a job interview and a woman sticks out her hand to shake a man's hand, that you're, or vice versa, that you're allowed to give a firm handshake, and that's not considered derech taiva. Because have you ever in your life, seen a married couple or a boyfriend and a girlfriend, or in a movie, or something, when they're trying to show a couple falling in love, a firm handshake, right? Like you'll never. That doesn't seem to be what we would consider derech taiva. However, when things are bederech taiva, that's a machlokas between the Rambam and the Ramban. The Rambam writes in Hilchos Yisurei Bia that kol haba al erva min ha'arayos derech evarim. If someone engages in intimate touch with one of the arayos, o shechibek v'nishek derech taiva, or even just hugging and kissing in a desirous way, v'nene b'kiruv basar, and they get pleasure out of that, hareza loka minatora. It is a violation of a lo sase minatora. It is a violation of a prohibition in the Torah. The Ramban disagrees. The Ramban says it's a prohibition midrabana, not a prohibition min hatorah. In Shulchan Aruch, we pass like the Rambam, that it's a prohibition min hatorah. So there's no real way of getting out of that prohibition in this case, because the whole point is that it should be b'derech taiva, right? That's the whole point, is that he should feel that sense of arousal. So that's going to be a real problem over here. As far as the risk of connecting with a non-Jew, that's also a significant problem. What exactly the problem is in terms of if he would end up marrying a non-Jew, and why it's usher, and what the issue is a much broader discussion, something we don't have time for. But everyone seems to assume it is the worst usher in the Torah to intermarry, even though we can't necessarily point to a pasuk that tells us that what exactly the prohibition is. There is a pasuk in the Torah that says lo seschatin bam, but that very likely only relates to the nations that inhabited Eretz Yisrael before we arrived. So it's not exactly clear what the pasuk is in the Torah, but there is a pasuk also lo yeh kadesh. Lo yeh kadesh means that you shouldn't be have a certain sexual freedom and just, have these non-committed relationships with people, which would be what we're trying to describe over here, that he's going to have this non-committed relationship with a person. But again, that would only be if it actually gets to the point where it's gone far beyond what this was supposed to be. So the question really becomes, it's certainly an Avera, right? It's certainly an Avera to engage in this kind of touch. Questions are, you allowed to violate Averas for a long-term long-term solution, for a long-term problem. You know, a person is allowed to violate a mitzvah saseh, for example, not to be sick, because the rule is you're allowed to spend your when you spend money on a mitzvah, you don't have to spend more than 20% of your money on a given mitzvah. And we assume lo yehi mamono chaviv alav megufo, that your money is no more valuable to you than your health is, and therefore we assume that a person doesn't have to get sick in order to fulfill the mitzvah in the Torah. The Gemara talks about an Amora who would drink 4 kosos of wine at the Seder, and he would be sick all the way until Shavuos, and the Poskim struggle with that. Like, why did he do that then? Maybe he shouldn't have drunk wine. Maybe, meaning this question of how far a person has to go. So they're sick and they're sick, but a person is allowed to violate certain things. We have a concept, mutav sheyichal Shabbos achas kedei sheyishmer Shabbos osarbe, that one of the reasons, one of the many reasons that the Gemara has as to why we're allowed to be mechal Shabbos to save a life, is that we'd rather be mechal one Shabbos in order that the person will be able to observe many Shabbosos in the future. If you have someone who's in a mental health facility and who's institutionalized and they don't serve kosher food, many poskim say if that's his only chance at recovery, leave him there and let him eat the non-kosher food, because he has to live a long, you hope that he'll be able to live a long productive life. That's what the Chasam Sofer writes in a tshuva. There's even a concept of avera lishma, of doing an avera for the proper long-term goals. Now, we can't be the judges in our own lives of when that's worth it and when that's not. It's something that requires a proper analysis of the sugya, of what kind of avera one is allowed to do in order to ensure long-term mental health and long-term productivity and long-term avodas Hashem. So that's what we have Gedolei Torah for. So I asked a couple of posts in this shaila, just to wrap it up. I asked Mori Virabi Rav Shech Shlita, and I asked Rav Asher Weiss this question. So Rav Shechter thought in this case a non-psak is best. Don't tell him to do anything. The biggest concern is that he will fall in love with the guy. He thinks that's going to be the biggest concern, is that he's going to fall in love with the woman and that it's going to lead to a long-term relationship. Maram Shik was asked if it's better for a woman to convert even though they're not going to observe the laws of Taras HaMishpacha, they're not going to observe the laws of Nida, or better to be married to a non-Jew. That was the case Maram Shik was presented with, where a couple was, a Jewish man was married to a non-Jewish woman. Now, as a non-Jewish woman, she doesn't have the status of Nida, but if she were to convert, she would have the status of Nida, and she was not willing to commit to go to the mikveh. And the Maram Shik said, intermarriage is worse. Intermarriage is worse than violation of Nida. So Rav Shechter pointed out, the whole tshuva is difficult to understand, because what kind of conversion is that? How do you convert someone who's not willing to accept the laws of family purity? I'm involved in a conversion based in. It's one of the basic questions you ask is, are you familiar with the laws of family purity? We set them up to someone to learn with them the laws of family purity. And if they say, no, I'm not committed to the laws of family purity, then I'm sorry, we're not going to do the conversion. So it's difficult to understand. However, the Maram Shik's assessment, his value assessment of Shechter thought is true, that better to be that being married to a non-Jew is the worst of the two evils. So Shechter thought, in all likelihood, if this guy doesn't figure this out in his life, then there's no way he's going to long term be a Torah observant Jew. Meaning, if he doesn't get this figured out, or not, no way, but there's a very, very slim chance of him continuing to observe Torah mitzvos. And considering this, Rav Shechter thought it may be worth the risk of developing this casually semi-intimate relationship with a non-Jew, but certainly you can't tell him that. Meaning, this is one of those non-psak issues. He said, do not tell him to do this. Give a non-psak, stressing how important it is for him to see if he can develop opposite gender attraction, or if he has opposite gender attraction somewhere within him. When I asked Rav Asher Weiss this question, so Rav Asher Weiss said he once had a very similar shaila, but it was different. He met a young man who went through this kind of therapy, but he said, it's not just go find a girl in college and take her out. He said, it was in a controlled environment. Someone pointed out before. He said, it's in a controlled environment. Everybody was fully dressed, involved holding hands, hugging. It was done with a professional who does this. And Rav Asher Weiss says, I know the guy. He's a Haredi guy. He's married with children. He says the therapy saved his life, and he's living a very happy life now, or at least it seems that way. The theory is, is that some negative sexual experience had caused something to go awry in his mind, and by creating some sort of positive association, and that we find a lot of times that in the world of mental health, that some sort of abuse or some sort of negative experience with sexuality causes just an overall unhealthy view of how to be able to be intimate with another person. So having a normal, non-threatening encounter will be helpful to the person in order to figure himself out, in order to be able to figure things out. So Rav Ashwai said, in no uncertain terms, do not find a non-Jewish woman in your graduate school to experiment on. Absolutely, absolutely not. And Rav Asher thought that a Jewish girl can do this because it's a controlled environment and she's doing it as a clinician. She's doing it as someone who's a trained therapist to be doing this. He didn't say, I didn't ask him whether the girl should go to the mikveh first, because in order to avoid nigia with a nida. So I'm not sure about that. But that's what he said should be done. But this is just a very, very complicated case. And it's something that has to go to Gedol Torah, in consultation with therapists who can understand what exactly is at stake over here. So again, the point of this was not to paskin for any if any case like this comes your way, say, oh, I heard a shir about that, I can paskin that for you, right? This is just something to open up our eyes to the kinds of complexities that rabbis and therapists deal with in the 21st century. And thank God we're a little more equipped to deal with in the 21st century probably than we were in the 20th century. But these are the kinds of things that that come up, and these are real people with real struggles that that we of course have to be sensitive to. And hopefully through the proper sensitivity and through dealing with people with a sense of respect and with a sense of love and concern, we'll be able to guide people to a sense of greater emotional stability and mental health. And people should always feel loved and always feel that the Ribbono Shel'olam loves them, and develop a sense of proper avodas Hashem. Everyone, thank you again so much for coming, and have a wonderful day.